So what fascinates me here about this poem and about what I've been thinking about is the idea of these paradoxes forming the way these opposites can lead to each other, and how in life opposites often lead to each other. So as I said, the enormity of God leads to the smallest, most helpless child. The powers of the angels in as they worship leads to the gentle kiss of a mother. And so I want to sort of dig into that idea a little bit, and I'm going to do that by reading from this book that I read recently, which is really fantastic, and we're going to come back to it a lot. But I just want to read the quote before I introduce the book to you, because I want them all to stay fresh on your mind. So this is talking about the idea of the nativity of Christ's birth and things like that. That is the idea of the nativity, that the infinite idea, the permanent presence, the thing beyond all things, might become the finite fact. The impertinent infant, that thing that wets itself at night, the kid in the corner. We all recognize that human renewal through the newborn child, whether its mother be virginal or merely young, is a glimpse of something amazing and miraculous in itself. Love's architecture in its own. The manger is inside us, and the mystery of birth and renewal, imagined as sacred or simply experienced as life, remains miraculous. It can never be parsed by critics, only praised by carols. The bleak midwinter passes as we sing the beauty of the baby. And so I'm gonna come back to this book a few times. This is a book, if you got the email I was talking about, it's called Winter. It's by a guy named Adam Gopnik, who's a writer. He writes a lot in The New Yorker. And it's part of the CBC Massey Lectures, which happen every year, which is a fantastic lecture series. Guys like Douglas Copeland, writers like Margaret Atwood, Claude Levi-Strauss, all these people, great thinkers of the last 50 years, have all given these Massey lectures and just introduced really incredible ideas to the world. It's kind of like a TED Talks, but given like 5 hours to talk. So there's some really amazing stuff there. So the reason I've been so captured by this book is because of this idea of paradoxes that he introduces. And the main paradox that one of the chapters introduces, he's got different chapters, one's on recreation of winter, one's on winter as an artistic theme, one of them is on sort of the vanishing reality of winter that we live with now, and one chapter is dedicated entirely to hockey. So if you're a hockey fan, it's great. And as a budding hockey fan myself, I was excited to read an intellectual take on hockey, which was often left by the wayside. So this idea of paradoxes, the idea that winter, the coldest physical season, is at once also the warmest season. Now, as residents of Winnipeg, we may doubt that. I read this week that Winnipeg is actually the coldest city in the world with a population over 700,000. So that's a dubious distinction, I suppose, to have. But we probably would doubt this idea that winter is actually the warmest. But I want to dig into that a little bit. To understand it, we're going to start in a very different era from our own. We're going to start at a time before motorized vehicles, before paved roads, when we were a much more rural sort of community. What winter brought in those times was an increase in mobility, a significant increase. No longer were farmers confined by impassable muddy roads, or broken carts, or even vast lakes. Winter brought with it ice, and with ice comes the mobility of sleds. And while we may think of winter as a season of isolation or hibernation, to our Canadian ancestors, winter was a season of social interaction. Remote villages became accessible. Estranged families were able to travel to one another far more conveniently than the summer months allowed. People would bundle up in their fur coats and get nice and close in a sleigh and travel, make these journeys through bleak midwinters in order to find the warmth of the hearth at the end of their journey. And it's by these fires, the hearths, that the true feelings of winter come alive. The warmth of companionship, camaraderie, the warmth of family becomes a reality. In this book, again, Gopnik quotes from a 19th century visitor to Canada who kept a journal. And so I'm going to read quickly just a short little thing that she wrote. It should seem that this wintry season, which appears to be so dismal, is for the Canadians the season of festivity. Now is the time for visiting, for sleighing excursions, for all in the course of business and friendship. Rushing off in the dead of January to see Niagara, winter sets us free. It's winter's ability to push humans together that gives it its warmth in a way that the swelter of summer, with its constant drive to do, cannot provide. Winter forces us to spend long bouts of time together to keep warm, and forces us to simply be rather than do. And it's in these moments that we can experience each other. But this idea is impossible without sort of the oppression or the hardship of winter. And it's that hardship that I want us to kind of think about. How does not only our perception, but our experience of winter shift when we actively delve into it? Think about your view of winter from behind the wheel of your car on a slushy day during rush hour. You've just left your office or wherever you were, and now you're on your way home. Think about the aggravation of blowing snow, the danger of icy roads, the hecticness of bumper-to-bumper traffic. And now think for some contrast. Consider cross-country skiing on a flat plane, or snowshoeing, or some other skating, that kind of thing, on the river. Think about walking through the city on a night when it's snowing, but a nice, not a blizzard kind of snow. It's a different feeling. And it's not just because in one case we're engaging in recreation and the other a necessary commute. It's because of how we approach the season. The big difference is how we're attempting to accomplish what we have to accomplish and using what we think is the most convenient method. So the car, as I was describing in the first instance, is the path of least resistance. It's private, it's quick, it requires a bare minimum of effort, just a little arm strength to move the wheel, even less leg strength to push the pedals. But the only problem is, there's 100,000 other people on the road that afternoon who have the exact same idea. And so we all individually and collectively push through this gridlock, becoming increasingly frustrated with everything around us. We tell ourselves and each other, I hate the snow, I hate the winter, I hate driving, I hate this city, I hate people. Our desire for private efficiency turns us into isolated islands of bitterness. Now think of the alternative again, this idyllic scene I was describing, engagement of winter via recreation. The active choice to turn winter from a burden into a chance for adventure. It doesn't seem to be saddled with the same sorts of anxieties and apprehensions. Is there something to be said for taking the road less traveled? How does this sort of thinking play into our relationships with each other? And most importantly, how does it play into our relationship with God? That's kind of what I want us to think about. So keep that question in mind. We're going to start by talking about life in general, and then we're going to move into the other areas that I was talking about. Have you ever been in the presence of somebody who is trying harder? I'm not talking about, like, the guy who tries too hard at the bar on Saturday night. That's just uncomfortable. I assume. but I'm thinking about maybe the host who makes you feel truly welcome in her house. Or a friend who actually wants to help you move. Or maybe a teacher who doesn't just instruct, but who inspires learning. Or maybe a boss who actually cares about the success and well-being of her employees. It's very different to be in the presence of someone who's just trying and someone who's just coasting and someone who's actually trying. As it happened, I saw this documentary this week about a musician named Paul Simon, whom you may have heard of. He's somewhat popular. And what it was she's nodding her head at me, I'm not sure. Anyway, it was about this album that he made in the mid-80s called Graceland, which is a fantastic album. And in fact, yesterday my wife was out shopping, Jane was out shopping downtown, and she came home with a copy of it on vinyl for me, which is Wonderful. I have a very good wife.
Just keep talking, she says.
Okay. Anyway, if you don't know this album, Graceland, you really should. But if you don't, one of its sort of hallmarks is the way that Paul Simon fused the sound, his own sound, with the sound of South Africa. And he used this group that's become more popular lately called Ladysmith Black Mambazo, who was unheard of at the time. And they're a vocal group, and he used them quite prominently through the album, as well as sort of delving into different rhythms and different ideas about songwriting. And so what this documentary that we watched about Graceland explores is how Simon left America to actually go and record in South Africa, because he just knew he wouldn't be able to reproduce the music that he was hearing. He had to go right to the source. Now, if anybody knows anything about sort of the recording process these days, it's not an easy process, but there's all sorts of things that are done to make it easier. Generally, when you're hearing a record, what you're hearing is the sound of a band or a group of musicians all playing separately to recordings of each other. And then all that gets put together in the end, and it makes it sound that you get this sort of illusion of that you're hearing music being played together. Why this is so popular is because obviously it makes certain things easier to control. You don't have sound bleeding over one to the other. You can really concentrate on individual performances without sort of having to stop the whole thing. You can jump in and cut and paste things if you want. But what it also does is it removes sort of one of the great things about music, which is sort of the spontaneous and improvisational spirit that can spark when a group of musicians are making music together. This is why so often people talk about bands being so much better live than on their albums. This is why in an age when we've sort of, as a culture, devalued recorded music by just sort of stealing it off the internet, we're still willing to pay hundreds of dollars to go see a band play for a couple hours. And by the way, you pay so much to see them play because you stop buying records. Just throwing that out there. But anyway, back to Paul Simon. He recognized that, as I said, there's no way that he could capture the sort of energy that he saw in these musicians by sort of breaking them apart and having them just record individually and try and make a song. And he also knew that in music in South Africa was much more of a communal experience than what we would be used to. And so in this footage that's in this documentary, you see all of these musicians kind of gathered in a big room playing together. There's also like their wives around and their kids who are sort of adding music or adding vocal parts and just sort of really upping the energy in the room. And the funniest part is to see Paul Simon, who I think is about this tall probably, trying to keep up with these guys and somehow corral this jam session into songs. But he did it. So anyway, by the end of the documentary, it becomes quite clear that nothing about the making of this album was simple. And yet each of the musicians that they interview, including Simon himself, speak about the great joy of the whole experience. On either side of the equation, they all learn from each other and grew as musicians. And the record itself is a testament to the effort that was put in. It's actually an incredible piece of work. And it's impossible to imagine sort of having that same collection of music if Paul Simon had just decided he was going to make an African record with some musicians in New York or Los Angeles or whatever. It just wouldn't have happened. And so there's this idea of the crucible. If anyone knows what a crucible is, it's this vat or whatever that's used to make metals or glass or things like that. And it's this extreme heat and pressure and all this sort of stuff which eventually produces something better than what went in originally. But you can't have that without sort of the trial of the crucible that the materials have to go through. And so what comes out at the end of this record is the sum of all the work that went in. Now, what is kind of a shame is that most music, even great music, eventually ends up as sort of background sound in a department store or as some sort of melody playing in an elevator. But that in no way sort of lessens the the efforts of great musicians. It's just sort of a tragedy of human's desire for the latest thing. And in a lot of ways, it's not unlike Christ's sacrifice that has become, in many ways, a lot of background noise that doesn't really get a lot of airplay on it anymore. And I'm not really speaking about sort of Christianity's diminished presence in broader culture. I'm thinking about the way that those of us who call ourselves Christians, Christ followers, tend to sometimes reject the idea of being Christ-like in favor of a much easier version of Christianity that has become, that's been sort of sold to us in the last, I don't know, 2,000 years probably, like so many iPhones. Very sleek, shiny, designed for ultimate convenience, and gives us easy access to the path of least resistance. I say into the iPhone. I'm well aware. But before I get too worried, this isn't one of those sermons that's going to end up with you all feeling guilty about not wanting to run off to work in a leper colony or something like that. That sort of life isn't for everyone. It's not for me. If it is for you, that's great. Go for it. But I'm really more interested in just thinking about our everyday lives, not sort of the grandiose, life-changing moves that lead people to the other side of the world. So don't worry, just stick with me here. Now, there's been a lot written about the theological implications of Christ's sacrifice. Scholars and theologians have filled libraries with theories about how what Christ did changed some essential thing about the way the universe works and about how God interacts with humanity. I'm not going to get into all that because we'd be here until next week. Because those are huge questions. But my question to God, if I were to be so bold as to ask God a question, would be, why did you go to all that trouble? Now, this isn't an unappreciative statement. Don't take it that way. But it's just a humble curiosity. Why would God, who created the universe and everything in it and can do anything, lower himself to the lowest state of humanity to become a humble craftsman from an unpopular part of an occupied country, and then on top of that, submit himself to torture and death at the hands of the very people he came to save? Now, of course, there's all sorts of writing about the notion of the sacrificial lamb, about Abraham's covenant, about the prophecies of Isaiah, the idea of spiritual warfare, but ultimately I'm still left asking why. Wasn't there an easier way? Why stand when you can sit, right? Why die, God, when you can just change your mind about the way things work? You're God. Now, of course, the arrogance of questions like that is clearly a product of our time. We live in an age when we still believe the next technological revolution or even product will solve all of humanity's issues. This has never worked in the past, but we still kind of hold out hope. When we think about technological revolutions, I think the best example would be the automobile, the car. It was supposed to make everyone's life easier, and it has for the people who can afford one, which is seems to be everybody nowadays. But anyway, its ability to allow us, the car's ability to allow us to be sedentary while in motion has contributed in no small part to major health problems in North America and the rest of the world. Its convenience has allowed our cities to balloon well beyond sustainable sizes. And the way it's changed the landscape has created a great deal of isolation, even within our communities. I did mention something about my parents here. Just their neighborhood, which has no sidewalks. Which I've mentioned to them many times before, so hopefully they won't be offended. But it's an interesting thing I notice when I drive down. So anyway,
you get laundry yards.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, more grass. So what, I mean, I could go on with other technological revolutions. I could talk about the way what television has done to us. I could talk about how the internet has sort of fragmented us into bullies with entitlement issues. How Facebook has sort of commercialized friendship while simultaneously making us hate each other because we can't believe that people would write these things to the whole world. And if you don't think what you write on Facebook can go out to the whole world, check out Lame Book sometime. You'll see what embarrassing things get posted. But anyway, I'm not going to go on that rant. But these sorts of ideas, this technological, this is a product of our culture and the way we're looking for the quick fix, the easy way out, the lowest common denominator, this path of least resistance. And I find it fascinating that Christ's example goes against this kind of thinking. He took the hard road. I've already mentioned sort of the political obstacles he faced, but have we ever even considered the time that he showed up? You think after, 14 billion years of the universe, what would have been another 2,000 years he could have waited to show up? In the words of Jesus Christ Superstar, Judas is singing to him from beyond the grave at one point, and he says, "If you'd come today, you could have reached a whole nation. Israel and BC had no mass communication." I'll stop there. I won't break into song. Nowadays, if Jesus came, he could get a TV show, or at least a pretty decent YouTube following. He could spread his message to the world. He's God, after all. I'm sure he could get airtime. He could amp up the production values, get some neat graphs going, maybe a pie chart. That was a joke from Mike Friesen, but I don't see him.
It's okay, I got it.
Yeah, okay. And then he could tell us, he'd go on TV, tell us we're all forgiven, and then head home. Maybe he could leave us with an app, even, to help us communicate. It would be a lot easier than trying to figure out the Holy Spirit, I feel like. He could have wrapped this whole thing up in a weekend, maybe. But he didn't. And he could still do it now, I'm sure. Because he's God. But he didn't do it. And I feel like that means something. We sometimes feel that we're entitled to the easiest way through life that we can find. To put in any effort sometimes is too much effort, if there's another way. Why browse the record store when you can download a whole album in less than a minute? Why visit a bookstore when you can download a book to your Kindle in seconds? Why visit a friend when you can just read his status updates? Why write a letter when you can just tweet? Why take a walk around the Forks or go skating when you can just drive to a mall and go from one heated box to another? Why go outside at all? We can get everything delivered. Why go to a church downtown that only has street parking and pay parking? Don't you know there's churches with parking lots out there? In fact, why go to church at all? We can just watch it on TV. There's a few options. Now, hopefully I recognize the craziness of the statement. I think that we all know if we're here, there's benefit to being here, or something about it that draws us here. And on top of that, Christ's example doesn't really support this kind of thinking. Nor did his example, nor the things that he said. I think we should consider the greatest commandment from Matthew 22. When the disciples ask him what is the greatest of the Ten Commandments, Christ throws him a curveball as usual and doesn't give him the Ten Commandments. He says, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself." I could just imagine these guys sitting around. "Oh, that's not so bad. Two commandments. That's less than 10. It's good. I don't even remember all 10. So, what were those two again, Jesus? Love? Yeah, that's easy. Wait, did you say everyone?" And he did. But we'll wait to get to everyone in a little bit. First, I just want to think about this idea of loving God. Because as easy as it seems, having 10 commandments would have been a lot easier. The 10 commandments were about obedience. They were rules that if you followed, you'd be square with God. But Christ isn't concerned about these rules. He wants a relationship. In this way, he's like anyone else. He wants us to love him as much as he loves us. I think that seems fair. But it's tough. Think about all of your heart, all of your soul, and all of your mind. It's a lot. Think about, just to sort of give an example of how sort of unusual this thinking is, think about a boss that you may have had. Maybe one you have now, maybe one you used to have. It doesn't have to be a bad boss, it could be a great boss. Just think about that boss. And now imagine if one day after years of being a faithful employee, of obeying sort of what they asked you to do, even if you didn't really understand it, your boss says to you, "What I really want is for you to love me. Love me, and then act in your job out of that love." I'm not going to get hung up on details or rules about following, about the rules that you're following, as long as you know that whatever, as long as I know that whatever you do, you're doing it out of love. Think about your boss. It's kind of awkward, hey? Think about hearing that. It wouldn't be very, definitely wouldn't be very easy. Now, of course, God is much better than a human boss, but the prospect is still quite daunting. When you really think about it, by contrast, it's much easier just to sort of follow some rules. Perhaps that's why we keep slipping back as a culture into legalism. We keep creating 12-step programs and quick fixes to make following Christ something small and manageable. You say this one prayer, and you're saved. But before you go, make sure you fill out this form so that we can track our conversion stats. And I just feel like that's not what Christ had in mind when he was hanging off the cross. He wasn't thinking, wow, this is a nice quick solution to that pesky gap between my dad and all these people. Problem solved. It's so easy. No, Christ put in the effort. He made that ultimate sacrifice. And we denigrate that effort when we try to reduce it to a simple, quick fix. We denigrate it when we think that we are upholding the first commandment by ignoring the second. By forcing our perception of morality on someone or some group that doesn't share our values is not loving our neighbor. Especially when we barely understand that morality ourselves. Christ tells us that whatever we do for the least of these in the world, we're doing for him. So when we discard those around us, we discard Christ. When we take the easy road in our relationships with each other and with God, we are degrading the effort that he put in. I hold to this belief that any great piece of art, whether it be a book or a film or a painting or even a snowstorm, requires as much effort from the spectator as from the artist to be fully appreciated. Art is not meant to be a passive experience. God's gift of life and his gift of salvation are his two greatest works of art. Aren't they worth the effort? As Rossetti said, what then can I give him? I'll give him my heart. So to close, I just want to come back to another poem, which I think has... I'm not going to explain too much. It's from Leonard Cohen, who's also rather popular. And he put out a new album this week, and as part of the promotion, they published one of the songs as a poem in The New Yorker. And so I just want to read the second stanza, because I think it says an interesting thing about putting our expectations on God instead of letting God just be God. So he says, he wants to write a love song, an anthem of forgiving, a manual for living with defeat. A cry above the suffering, a sacrifice recovering, but that isn't what I want him to complete. I want to make him certain that he doesn't have a burden, that he doesn't need a vision, that he only has permission to do my instant bidding, to say what I have told him, to repeat.